Session number 106, double nine.
Brigadier Rymer Jones, Reel 9. We were talking about the morale midway through to or towards the end of the Ypres campaign in 1917, and you said that a lot of you were feeling pretty low. How did that express itself amongst the officers and the men and yourself?
It didn't express itself in any lowering of morale at all. Not at all. You must remember that there was the morale of pride of unit. We were the Guards Division, and that was the last thing that would happen to any of our people. And it was terribly high. The men were gaining a terrific lot of medals, you know, and as I've described with the signalers, you took it. Don't forget that all these fellows were still the volunteers in the first million, and that we all went out. I went out with the knowledge that I would be killed in my turn. All my friends were. And it would be an insult if you weren't, really, or if you weren't in a position to be killed. And there were very few. You know the old stories in England about white feathers and so on. There was extremely little of that, except among a lot of rather poetic chaps and so on. But even those, when they were hauled in, did very well as RAMC stuff and so on, as long as they hadn't got to kill anybody. It wasn't a question of cowardice. But the rest of them, the famous first 100,000 of Ian Kay's story and so on, it was terrific. There was no question of giving away, but you could beginning to get very annoyed with your higher staff, you know. And we were furious that we were still getting shrapnel, no high explosive at all. And we didn't some time after.
Were there any cases of shell shock in the battery that you were aware of?
No. I think I was the nearest to shell shock in trench mortars.
You told us that
I
story,
told you
yes,
the
when you had a
story.
near miss.
But I don't think. Well, I told you that when I arrived at the battery, that all the officers had been killed, and the major, who was as an OP, was very near a big burst, and he had shell shock. Not to the extent of being dim-witted, you know, like the terrible cases where I've seen them where the wretched victims, who would be quite stout-hearted normally, suffering from shell shock, and if you had them in a room, they'd be struggling to get under the table, nothing happening at all. Terrible, terrible show. I met shell shock victims after the war, who for years and years in army hospitals for this sort of thing. It is definitely a disease through your nerve being shattered in some way. But we are very fortunate. I think we may have had one or two minor ones, but it was wounds which are the trouble. And before we'd got down there, when we were up near the house with the leaning tree, a wagon did come up one day, and that was as he came over the canal there, the Yser Canal, and delivered his stuff at headquarters. And that was when I had a battery fairly close to, before we got down to the Steenwijk. And so I said, I'll come with you on your wagon to see you across the Isar Canal on their way back to the wagon land. And he was hit when we were sitting there going down by a shell. He had a great hole in his back. Well, he was wearing a greatcoat. And there was nothing you could do. You couldn't get it off till he got back to, you know, the expert treatment. And he thought he was dying. He may have died. And so you went through the usual thing. I got his first aid thing. And funnily enough, they did it, just restored it. They got some cranky idea that you mustn't use iodine in the wounds. Well, it's a thing you always did, of course. But luckily, they'd restored it again. So all I could do was to empty it onto a big pad and stuff it over the hole through his overcoat, and then bind the whole thing up and hope for the best. I often wondered whether he'd... And at the same time, you went through the usual motions of saying, you're a lucky chap, you'll be all right, you'll be in Blighty tomorrow, you see. I can't think that he'd probably done the same to many other cases himself. You shoved a cigarette in his mouth and lit it and hope for the best.
Now, well, at this time, it was when you were invited back for a meal with Hickory.
No, this was much later. As I said, we were down there all rather fed
up. Yes, that's what I meant, sorry.
Yeah, well, Charles Vickery, who was very good when it came to the point, as I've described, with all the things we used to get out at his suggestion, and he felt that one or two of our fellows had been rather, let's call it, overworked. And that included me. I was the first one to go, actually. And he invited me back from the battery, from Pilgrim Chateau, to go back to his ridge behind and have a night with him in his pillbox. Now, in his pillbox were Charles Vickery, his adjutant, grand young man. He was only about 20 then, I think. And the orderly officer. All right, I arrived there, and there, as with always with Charles Vickery, and very much more so later, in front of Arras, a table set. It is a pillbox, but half the size of this room.
About 6 foot by 10.
There. And lovely white cloth, nice things to eat with, and excellent food. And that's what always amused me, because when we came to the drink at the end, he seized a bottle and said, pass, there were only the four of us, you see. Five. Pass Uncle's port round. Brandy, sorry. Pass Uncle's brandy round. Reimer doesn't like it, so give him the cork to get the bouquet. And then afterwards we had this marvellous stuff where he got on the phone to Gunner Divisional Headquarters, and his friend Wilfred Rogers, who was one of the staff there. Wilfred, come on. Put on the Divine Master. That meant that he was going to put a Caruso record on that, which was linked to us, you see, by wire. And then he grabbed the two-piece show himself and shoved a dirty old one-piece one to me. And there we sat listening to what he called the Divine Master singing Massenet's Elegy. marvellous, I'd say. I can't tell you what this meant, you know. Then he'd say to orderly officer and adjutant, Flossie and Lizzie, go behind and get the bed, cap bed, mark it, ready for me. And there I was put to bed with sheets and everything. And next morning early, of course, I went back to the battery. And that was a great, talk about morale, terrific morale booster, you know.
Why the joke about you in particular not liking brandy? Why the joke about you in particular not liking brandy? What had caused that?
He knew that because I was rather a favourite of his, you know. And I'd been to dinner with him before. And he knew I didn't like brandy. In fact, I drank very little.
Did many officers drink much in the battery lines, or would they only drink
not in the battery lines, no. I could tell you a story now, which came much later in my...
We'll come to that later, then, yes.
So
you went back to your battery in the
steam? I went back to my battery, and somebody else was pulled out. But it wasn't long before they said, well, the battle ends now. And the Guards Division, which had been... We were the only people in the whole time, you see. And there was another division came in to relieve the guards again. They'd been out on rest before. And we were pulled out too. Well, I can well remember... Sitting around, we couldn't speak. We'd lost our voices. We'd always gasped. So. Or we could only sort of drivel out a few words. And I was rather badly burnt underneath. And till it came to the second day out, when they said, all right, you're going south. The division's going south. So I didn't know where they were going at all. They were actually going to prepare for Cambrai. And so off we went. You see, one lived on a horse when you weren't in the firing line. And off we went till we got to a place called Merville, which was behind the Portuguese. Were occupying that part of it. And I handed over the guns to the what they call the IOM in those days, the Inspector of Ordnance Machinery, to clean up. And he had a very nice doctor friend out there. And they seemed to take a liking to me too. And apparently they were worried about my gas effects, you see. So before I knew what was happening, an ambulance arrived and took me off to a hospital in northern France, leaving the guns. Of course, I got onto the... And they sent for the guns. And I was only one night where I met my old school matron, a wonderful woman who'd been in the Boer War as a nursing sister. And when she came in to go round the patients at night, she opened the door and she said, one of my boys, she said, Rhymer Jones, you're sick again. Because I was always getting mumps or measles at school, you see. You're a wonderful woman. And next morning I found myself railed off to the south of France. Lady Mitchellum took over a place in Dieppe in the summer. In the winter she had this marvellous hotel that Capmata, which he paid for entirely, full of officers who'd been wounded.
Were your burns treated at all, or were they just left to heal?
Oh, I think they were dressed that night, but it was... You would imagine if you had a burn, you don't call that a casualty, do you? There was nothing particularly wrong with me. What was mostly wrong with me was, of course, was the effect it had on my chest and... What's my problem? But by the time I'd done my fortnight and met the girl who I said I got to marry her, and did by an extraordinary coincidence later, I went back to the battery and they were in the last stages of the Cambrai battle. And that was there one of the great moments of my life. The guards were out at rest after all this Passchendaele show, and they'd sent for the band from home to amuse the troops and so on. And then Passchendaele came along. Cambrai. Cambrai, you know, was another disaster. It was a very successful tank raid to start with. And, of course, the silly asses at General Headquarters had to come in and say, oh, this marvellous success, we must now expand it. They'd got nothing except the cavalry corps. I think there were 6 divisions of cavalry. They're absolutely useless, poor souls. And so they tried to use them very badly. My old division had captured Bourlon Wood, and it was very nice to hear. And later in the German attack, I heard that 2 of my trench mortar men, one was the fellow who'd been a Carter Patterson's boy before the war, I liked very much, silly little man, and when the Germans had one of their terribly successful attacks, at the end of March of the following year, he and this fellow didn't retire like most did. They barricaded themselves in and fought it out till the end, and my Carter Patterson's boy died a hero. Marvellous. It upset me quite a lot. And at any rate, I arrived back at these last stages where the Germans had counterattacked and had, even in some cases in our area, gone further than we'd started from in the successful attack. And the most amazing sight, it was one case where there was panic. And over the ridge in front of us were streaming infantry wagons and so on, all coming hell for leather for the horizon through our land. And even the troops were coming back pretty fast. And we could see ourselves having to have our guns round 180 degrees. And then the marvellous thing happened. And the guards on rest who'd been alerted, the brigade came up the road in column of 4s, as if they were on a peacetime routine march, and the band. And leading them was the brigade commander, Crawley de Crepinay, on a horse. I'm not sure he didn't have a soft hat on, was very naughty, but of course the effect of morale was terrific. And they went through our lines like that. And when they got up a bit further, they shook out into battle order, of course, and got back the most vital parts of what we'd lost in the German counterattack. It was tremendous. then almost moved straight away with the brigade and the division to Arras.
So that would be late-ish November 17 or perhaps into December after Cambrai.
Cambrai was November. I could have told you an hour ago the actual date, but I'd like that now, I'm sorry.
We'll put it in later, perhaps. So, you moved down to Arras, and whereabouts at Arras was your battery position?
Well, Arras, you know, was another of these. Funnily enough, it was Allenby who was in charge, who was so successful in Palestine afterwards. He was a great man. But he was rather let down by behind with lack of reserves and so on. And as usual, it was one of the, it was always in order to save the French who were going through difficulties somewhere else. And I must say that the French did the same with us. But at any rate, it was left us in a large salient where the Germans, we got a lot of ground, but the Germans had all the observation. And we were in a place called Death Valley. It wasn't very rough at all at that stage.
Whereabouts exactly is that?
In front of Arras. Can't remember the river was nearby, but our guns were at the top of a long slope of the valley, and from there you could see over the German lines, roughly. Well, our guns, which we apparently had taken over, were on the crest. Lovely targets for the Germans, if they'd been asses enough to use it then. But they'd made marvellous notes of this, you can be quite sure. And we had a camouflage on top, and they looked like young haystacks. We didn't have a lot of trouble with the Germans at that stage. But going forward to OP work was that you drop down into what you might call the most rearmost trenches, and you could still see a certain amount of the country opposite where it rose again. And so that on this particular occasion I was standing in an open trench there, sharing an OP, which was a slit in the front part of this trench, and where a machine gunner was using that for his machine gun, because, and at the same time, he had a bit of stuff in front of a hole through, and when we wanted to observe, we used this, I used it too, you see. Well, the snow was on the ground. It was damn cold. And I was there all day. So when I got back to the battery, the only fun I'd had was shooting at a German who, in great confidence behind his lines, was coming out going to his loo, apparently. So I had to rouse the battery and fire. Quite stupidly, of course. But that was the only thing that happened at all until I got back to the battery, and Colonel Vickery was on it. He said, "Come to dinner, my boy." He was right at the back of this slope where there was a sunken short trench, blind trench, and half a Nissen hut had been dug down in there, you see? And this is what he'd made his headquarters. Always making great comfort out of unnecessary discomfort. And I said, "Would you mind, sir? I've been standing at I'm very tired of standing at an open trench all day, and I'm not fit to see anybody. He said, well, come to coffee afterwards. I said, all right, okay, sir. So I drifted down afterwards, after I'd had a bit of a polish up. And as I got down into this short trench, I heard sounds of music, lights. When I got closer, I saw that Charles Vickery had got the whole thing, his napery, even silver, marvellous show. And there I found, when one was at the wagon lines there, one was very near a Royal Flying Corps. They weren't the RAF then. Observations group, which was, the chap in charge was a very nice fellow, Guy, can't remember his name.
Garrod, was it?
Garrod, Guy Garrod, who'd been a very keen infantry officer before the war and was a great man for Bisley, for shooting and so on. Very correct in every way. But if you were at the wagon lines, he let you have flights with his fellows who were observing over the lines and go over your old, your battery position to try and drop rude messages on them. Of course, you didn't get within miles of it. And apparently he'd got himself engaged to the very nice matron of a casualty clearing station. It's like a forward hospital, you know. And Charles had invited them in a fatherly way to come and have dine with him too up there. Very naughty. And so they came. It was near a place called Fampu. I remember the river too in a minute. So the road was alongside the valley, so they only had to get out of their car and come along in this trench, you see. And we had a great evening. I always remember they made me play up Jenkins, of all stupid things.
What's that?
You have coins in one hand, and you back down in English. Which is it? You know. And you say, I'll tip it in that hand. I don't know what it all meant. And very childish games. We played childish games like this, you see. Had a marvellous dinner. And then Charles said, all right, you go and see him off. Their car will be out there now. So I did. And a couple of minutes after I got back, the whole valley was full of mustard gas. So Charles was very lucky to get away with it, I think.
And his fiancée, even more so.
What?
I presume his fiancée, even more so. She shouldn't have been there, should she?
Well, I think it was rather too far forward to allow, even if she was a matron.